Knock Hawk. My name is Tracy. And I'm grateful to be here tonight. You never know how this is really going to come out. Thank you for asking me to speak. And I especially want to point out my sponsor is here with me, and special friend from my home group. And I'm just going to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I live in Charlottesville, Keswick, actually. My first experience with alcohol was basically, when I was about 15 years old. I grew up in Fluviana County. Some of you may have heard of that. They like their beer, and I like my beer. And my first experience with drinking alcohol was a hot summer night at the drive-in. It was Busch beer, you know, just, it was the magic, you know, elixir that kind of took me there. I grew up a small family, had one brother, and we, I think my family, looking back, we tried to put on the facade that everything was okay. There was really not a lot of meat in our connection with each other or communication. It was all about the events of our day, the comings and goings. We did go to church, a Southern Baptist church, but what I remember of spirituality or God was feeling forced and not having a choice and not having any questions that I had about that welcomed in the church that I went to. It wasn't really a conservative church, but it wasn't liberal. It didn't feed my spirit as a young person. By the time I found alcohol at the age of 15, my spiritual quest had ended because I was just like, that was, you know, my higher power. That was the only thing that gave me any courage. From the time that I was 15, it was all about fitting in. In going over my story this afternoon, there's some things that I haven't shared before in the past months when I've shared my story, but looking back, I just see how many uncomfortable situations I put myself in as a young person in order to fit in with somebody else's dream of me. I played basketball. I wasn't very good, but I made the team, and you know, we had a state championship basketball team, and basically the only time I played was at the end of the game if we were winning by like 50 points or, you know, whatever. But I wasn't really athletic, but I just did it, you know. It wasn't my heart, but I just did it because I wanted to fit in or for some reason. I also played tennis. I wasn't very good at that. I was Miss Fluviana in 1982, like on a dare. I bought a dress and went into this contest, and I remember coming home that night, my mother meeting me at the door. I was wasted. I was just so drunk. I was 17. I don't think I was 17 at that point. And then I remember my mother being really disappointed and not speaking to me and like slamming the dishes the next morning, and then nothing. No conversation. Just it slid under the radar. And that same year, I was drinking in public with some friends in a parking lot, and there was like an undercover cop who was like watching all of us and, you know, dragged us all downtown, about 10 of us, called our parents. And I remember my parents didn't speak to me for a couple of weeks, but they never addressed the drinking or, you know, any of that. Oddly enough, alcohol had been a part of my family's life, you know, way before me. My mother, her father was killed in an alcoholic car crash when she was 13. He was driving like 100 miles an hour. Four men in the car, they all died. And that wasn't ever termed alcoholism. I'm quite sure it was. I mean, my mother also had a brother who at the age of 41, after being in and out of jail and out of prison, ended his life with pills and booze. Again, wasn't addiction, it was termed insanity, which of course it was a form of insanity, but quite clearly we just didn't know what addiction looked like. It was never a valid topic to talk about. In my parents' home, they didn't drink. They didn't have alcohol in the home. When we went out to dinner, they didn't drink. They were teetotalers. Now, I found out later that when they were first married, my father was 21, my mom was 16, and my dad did drink. And I think my mom kind of like put a stop to it. And if he drank, it was like when he was away or like when she couldn't be around to smell it. But we never had it in the home, so I never learned any rules or healthy behaviors around alcohol. Long and the short of it is, I'm hardwired to be an addict, and I triggered my addiction the first time I got drunk, I believe. So from 15 to 18, it was the dance and the romance with alcohol, and throwing in some regrettable acts and positions that I put myself in that I could have been killed or worse. But by the time I was 18, I was drinking, I was blackout drinking, and there was hardly a day that I didn't drink. All the friends that I chose during that time, or that chose me, also drank that way. It was just a part of every event was around what wine's going to go with this, what, you know, if we're going to go to Foxfield, if we're going to do this, if we're going to do that, it's going to be centered around alcohol. Every little beach outing, everything was centered around alcohol. And I thought that was normal. I didn't see a problem. If I had to lay on the couch until 2 o'clock with dry heaves and try to choke down some tomato soup until I could get up and do it again, I did it. I thought that was just kind of the deal. When I look back on that part of my life, from the age of 18 until 29, when I first came into AA, I can see where my dreams and my standards just started going, you know, down the rungs of the ladder. I didn't follow through with college. I was a horrible employee. If I was temperamental, I would just, you know, throw something and quit. That was how I rolled. I didn't need a job. I wasn't grateful to have it. The classes that I would enroll in college, if I felt confident and felt good at them, I would go and enjoy them if I liked the professor. Otherwise, I just didn't bother. So my GPA was not all that great. One thing that is important, too, during my younger years, I was kind of like the superstar student up until about 7th or 8th grade. And then, you know, puberty hit, popularity hit, and it was more important to drink and have a boyfriend than anything else, and that's all I wanted. So I didn't really apply to a college. I went to a community college. And those dreams were just on hold. I barely graduated from high school, and I was, you know, a smart girl. I just wasn't, I'll say I didn't have any guidance, but I wasn't finding my path. I just was, you know, settling for whatever life threw at me. And I did that for many years, and I that's still my default mode, is to feel like the victim, and this is what I got, and this is, isn't this terrible? So, let's see. I guess, fast forward to about age of 25. I was living in Stanton. I was working as a waitress in a restaurant, and the chef of the restaurant and I ended up dating for a very short time, and that was my first husband. That environment was conducive to drinking big time. I don't know if any of you have ever worked in a restaurant, but, I mean, it's perfect. And, you know, it's basically after you close all the booze you can drink, you don't have to come back in until 4 or 5 the next morning. It's just, it's a dream. You leave with cash. Not only that, the people are pretty unhealthy. I mean, a lot of them just kind of become each other's world, and that's what happened with my first husband. I was usually passed out by the time he got home. He liked cocaine and other women, so it worked out beautifully. We just really didn't pay attention to each other. He's not a bad guy, but I don't know what I was thinking. And so that marriage, during the course of that marriage, I'll just say, one of the I won't even say that it's a decision, but we make these decisions in our life that when things come up, it kind of changes the course of your life. And for me, I was married. The marriage was on the rocks, and I knew that we weren't going to stay together. And I couldn't stop drinking. I had been setting all these deadlines and making deals with myself that, you know, next weekend it's going to start. I'm going to be sober, you know. I had no idea what sobriety looked like, but it, to me it was just not drinking. And I remember when I was living in Lexington calling a treatment center here in Charlottesville. I think it was called Turning Point or something. And just kind of getting everything lined up. I was going to go to the treatment center, called my boss at the newspaper and said, I'm going to, you know, be gone for however long. And my husband, my parents, several friends and coworkers, just, they're like, Trace, you're not an alcoholic. I mean, you party. You have a good time. You're not an alcoholic. I mean, look at what that means. And I just, you know, I can't blame them. I just bought into it. And I remember the counselor that I had talked to on the phone called me for weeks after that, you know. I guess they're supposed to for marketing or whatever. But, I mean, they called to check on me, and I just said exactly what you hear. You know, I'm fine. I'm, you know, either I'm not drinking or I'm controlling it or whatever. It was a scary place, and I was scared. But I also found out during that time that I was pregnant. And, you know, it was really the last thing I needed. I wasn't ready to put down the booze. And when I found out that I was pregnant, I was almost 3 months pregnant. And I had been blackout drinking just about every day of that 3 months. And so I made a decision that I would end the pregnancy. And that cost me, that was basically the end of my marriage. Not that I wanted to save the marriage. I really don't have a clear thought about whether that could have worked or not. But I attribute that decision on alcohol. And it's one of the, when you, that's part of the past that I'd like to shut the door on, but I can't. So that same year, I guess that was, I was 28, I was 29 when my husband and I split up, and July 13th, of 1994, I went into my first AA meeting. I had been calling the AA hotline ever since the time that I'd called the treatment center. And there's this woman named Sally in Lexington, Virginia. You know, this huge, gregarious, bubbly, loving woman that used to talk to me on the phone. She wouldn't talk to me when I was drinking, and I didn't understand that. And I was like, this is when I need you the most. And she's like, I'm not going to talk to you when you're drinking. But I hit a bottom that day in July. I had been separated for about 6 months. The marriage was over. And I was still making the same bad decisions. Woke up with a horrific hangover, sick in the shower, thinking I can make it to work today. I remember having fallen down the steps the night before and wondering where all these bruises came from. Had, you know, a guy with me that I really didn't want there. And I remember just like flipping out and like throwing him out of my house like he was some kind of criminal, you know. I was like, get out. And that was the day I think I just hit an alcoholic bottom. I wasn't convinced, you know, before that, because I was really trying to reason out. The costs weren't high enough yet for me. I didn't have a DUI, I'd never been arrested. You know, yes, my life was unmanageable, and alcohol was no friend to me, but it was really all I had left, you know, to alter my consciousness, and it really, there was no buzz at that point. I would drink straight into a blackout. It wasn't like I would pick it up and have this refreshing, you know, I was way, way past that. The other interesting thing is, all during these years, I had many drugs offered to me. I had many drugs available to me. The only drug I ever tried during that period was pot, and it just harshed my alcohol buzz so bad that I just hated pot. I was like, why do they smoke this stuff? Just give me a drink, you know. And I never tried, you know, drugs really aren't a part of my story, and I'm kind of glad about that, because I don't know what would have happened, you know, if I'd picked up a drug. I think I'm hardwired for just about anything, from chocolate to men to red wine, you name it. I mean, I can get addicted to it, you know. So I have to say, if any of you know where Glasgow, Virginia is, It was a smoking meeting. There were a lot of bikers there. There were a lot of, kind of my perception was crotchety old men, and a couple of ladies sitting in the back knitting. I was like, what is up with this? They are so not like me. Of course, I'm just, babbling and crying and whatever. And, they just turned that meeting over to me. I remember that. And by the time I left, I felt like, wow, they really care. I didn't remember feeling that ever. And they just listened. And so from that day, I didn't take a drink for over 9 years. I worked a really good program in AA. I was blessed with wonderful sponsors during that time. My first year of sobriety, when I was 29, I did everything you're not supposed to do in sobriety, and somehow I still stayed sober. I had, men strewn, through the rooms, just relationship after relationship. During that period, too, I had a friend that I had met in Charlottesville. We had been friends for about 8 years, and in 1994, he died of AIDS, and it was right around my six-month sobriety date. And he had invited me into his home with his family, to just be there and be present with him during those last 6 months. And I really, that's one of my sober gifts of that period of my life, because, I just wouldn't have been in any shape to do any of that or just to show up and be present with them. And the not-so-odd thing about that is that my friend, his name is Scott, had been the one all those years ago back in Charlottesville, picking me up, cleaning up my mess, just dealing with his drunk friend Tracy, who pointed out to me how ugly I was when I drank and the things that I did. I was like, I don't remember. He's like, well, let me tell you. Sit down. And I'm like, oh, okay. And he would tell me, and it wasn't pretty. And I was just in denial about that for a long time. But, before his death, we had many talks around that. He's like, I'm so proud of you. And I wasn't doing it for him, but I could just feel that I was making a change. I was making a shift. And the people in AA, I guess it took me, many months to get over that, the death of my friend. But, I remember them just carrying me. I remember staying at my sponsor's house. She drove down with me many times to Gloucester, where his family lived. That was huge stuff, and I wasn't close to my family, and that was my family. So from the age of 30 until about 35, 36, I was just like the AA poster girl. Sponsored women, went to the jails, did this, did that, and most of it was in Roanoke, Virginia. And I had this happy life. I mean, started building up a resume, started, getting jobs that I really wanted to do versus jobs that were just kind of things that I could get. And the weird thing was, I got a lot of the things that I had hoped and dreamed for, and most of the things that I had hoped and dreamed for were small potatoes compared to what I got. I had really good friends, had mended a lot of relationships, especially with my mother during that period of time. And at the age of 36, my spiritual quest took me to some different levels. Like, I started going to a different kind of church and doing Buddhist meditation and, doing yoga and started teaching yoga. And just my world opened up and my meetings started coming. It was harder for me to get to meetings, just fitting in my whole busy life, And then the point came where, after I married my second husband, we moved out near Blacksburg, and it was further away from my meetings in Roanoke. of course, I wasn't going to go to Christiansburg and Blacksburg to go to meetings. Forget that. And I didn't need them that much. You know, I'd been sober for a long time, and I just started cutting it out of my life. And my sponsor, God bless her, her name was Cindy. She was my sponsor for 6 years. And she was so loving. She would call me, and it just, you know, she didn't give me a lot of shit. She just said, you know, I miss you. And she would meet me for coffee outside the rooms, and we would talk about everything that was going on. She came to my wedding, to my husband. And she was just kind of the hand that never let go. And I just walked away from it. By the time, let's see, it was 2002, about a year of not going to meetings, I had a drink in my hand. It was a little over a year. And then another year after that, let me back up. What I'll say is my big, there's a word I use for it, I hope it doesn't offend anybody, this big mind fuck that I did on myself was that I had made peace with alcohol. And that, you know, somebody who gave it up for 9 years really wasn't going to be affected if they picked up another drink. And I really believe, like, I believe that. I drank like a lady for a little while and just kept, you know, having a glass here and there, not having a result. Of course, it didn't feel that good. So I don't know really why I was doing it. I know why I was doing it, because my disease was whispering in my ear, you know, this is how we're going to do it, and you're fine. So by the time my second marriage was on the rocks, and I hadn't been to a meeting in 2 years, and I separated from my husband, and by the time I moved to Charlottesville in November of 2005, it was the same old Tracy. And in fact, it was worse, because my belief is, and I've proven it to myself, it's a progressive disease. I didn't pick up where I left off. I picked up as if, you know, I had been drinking the whole nine yards. And that's a hard thing to accept, and it confused me. I'm like, I know I'm a little bit older, but my God. You know, I had vicious hangovers, and it didn't take anything to get me to a blackout. I don't think I even had really an alcoholic buzz during my whole relapse. It was just straight on. And also Charlottesville is a big trigger town for me. This is where I learned to drink. And I never lived sober in Charlottesville. And there, I don't think that's a myth. I think really when you're, you know, creating your reality, I think that's true. It's been really hard for me to roam around Charlottesville as a sober woman. But I've done it. So, I don't really have a lot of drinking stories to share. It's just the same old stuff you guys know. People, places, and things. Pretty wretched. October of 06, dating a married man, working as a probation officer in Charlottesville, driving a state car, drunk, badging my way out of speeding tickets, and a couple of DUIs, you know, not pretty. And so really, the thing is, I could be in jail right now, but I'm not. Something in me, I was working, I wanted to die so bad. I had gone through a period of thinking, like analyzing my drinking and then still letting myself off the hook about the drinking. It's not the drinking. You know, it just wasn't the drinking. And it would be the drinking until 4 p.m. when I was in the beer and wine aisle, and then it wasn't again. It's really confusing. But then I called the EAP from my work and, you know, just said, you know, I'm suicidal. And I don't know where that came from, because I know the minute that you say that, people are going to try to help you. I wasn't really willing to tell anybody in my life that knew me or that I could see, or like my family or coworkers, but I knew that it was true, and there was like a little mustard seed that wanted to survive, you know, and not die. But I still honestly did not believe that it was the alcohol. And Isaiah, I was just sitting there, and how I was going to do it, I was going to drive in front of a train. I had it all planned out. It was just going to be, was it morning or afternoon train? I didn't know that yet. I thought that was how it was going to go. And I got hooked up with a counselor in late October of 06 and started, seeing him. And I guess he just spotted me a mile away. It takes one to know one. He was 17 years in recovery. That's the God stuff, because I really believe that if I hadn't had exactly that counselor, I don't think I would have pulled through, because I had some big resistance. And he very gently, very lovingly, but I don't know, it made me furious, would, prod me. He didn't ask me about my drinking now. He's like, tell me what it was like before when you were sober. That messed me up. I was like, I don't want to talk about that. What difference does it make? He's like, well, I just want to know what made you stop drinking for 9 years. Tell me what that was like, before that. So he was basically recreating my story in the present moment from the past, and that just wasn't fair. I was like, I don't want to do this. He just kept trying to get me to go to one meeting. And I was like, what is the deal with the meeting? It's not the alcohol. And then he started contracting with me to not drink while we were working together. And being a counselor myself, I had respect enough for him to not, lie to him. I said, I did drink. He's like, okay, well, let's go to a meeting or whatever. And so finally, I just was in enough pain and had days where I'd called in sick to work, vicious hangovers where I thought, I'm going to have to go to the fucking hospital. I am so sick. I mean, I just thought this was going to take me out. And I went to my first AA meeting and picked up a white chip on December 30th of 06. So I have like a year and change, a few months. But, I do not remember when I was 29 that it was that hard to put down a drink. It was like the hardest 6 or 8 months of my life, because it was just whispering to me. It was trying really hard. And it wasn't the, we're going to have a drink. It's why live? It was really going to that part of me. And that was, that's what AA has done for me in this past year. It's given me a life that I don't want to give up. I have no fear of death, but I like my life. And I don't know why I let it go before, but, with the help of my sponsor, I'm letting that go, because it doesn't matter. Everything that happened brought me to this point. And the way that the Big Book terms it, it's my biggest asset to help someone else. And I've recently started sponsoring women, and one of the women that I'm sponsoring is, chronic relapser. And she told me the other day, she said that she asked me to sponsor her because she heard me share about, my relapse, and that, I'd kind of made peace with it. Some days I have, some days I haven't. But, the truth is that I don't think I had the gift of desperation when I came into AA at the age of 29. I think maybe I just wanted to stop drinking. But when I came in this time, it was like I wanted to live. I knew what I could get here. I knew it was going to take. Actually, I didn't, because it turned out to be a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. And my life looks totally different today. I mean, I have a commitment to AA. I go to a lot of meetings. I go to, 4, 5, 7 meetings a week. I've had some health issues that are kind of linked to my years of drinking. It's been kind of scary to deal with all this stuff. But I found a wonderful sponsor, working the steps, making connections with women. And, I wouldn't trade it. I never wanted to be a joiner. And I have a fantastic home group. I mean, they're big on service, and sometimes I'm really not. But they challenge me, and I'm part of the group. And I have a seat every time I go. And I'm really proud of that, and I'm really happy, and I'm really, really grateful. And I guess the one thing that I wanted to share about my spiritual journey is that we talk a lot about the steps in my home group. We read the steps. We do a lot of step work. I do step work with my sponsor. And we had a really powerful meeting on the 11th step yesterday. And part of, I believe, what took me out the first time was my spiritual quest. I got all cocky with spirituality and what it looked like. And I did a lot of outside things to feed my spirit at the while sacrificing my AA program. And I realized, you know, I've never been to a treatment center. I made a contract with my sponsor that if I relapse this time that I would go into a treatment center, but I haven't. I believe that, you know, AA gave me my higher power, helped me find my higher power. So it doesn't matter, you know, I don't have to go to, you know, the weekend silent retreat 5 times a year, and I don't have to, you know, sit in front of my altar for 2 hours at a stretch. Really, all I need to do is to get in touch with my higher power is go to a lot of meetings and call up people and be in contact. Now, I have those little spiritual experiences where it's just me and God, and that's powerful and great. But if I include other people, not only am I helping them in some ways, I'm also, it's like a little insurance policy. The people around me, I've given them permission to kind of read me and be there for me and spot check me when I can't do it for myself. And I don't like it, but that's how it works. That's why it works for me. I'm not ashamed of that. I feel like the God that I have here in this room is the same God that I take with me, you know, everywhere to do all those other practices. And I don't have to sacrifice, you know, because this is my spiritual home. And for me, as an alcoholic, I need to be in constant contact with other alcoholics. You know, that's the essence of my connection with God today. And I didn't have that before, and I don't think I would have known that before my relapse. That's what it took. So with that, I think I'm finished, and I'm grateful that you guys were here. Thank you.